9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0.
Hello and welcome to the Cycling Podcast. My name is Richard Moore. I'm with Lionel Burney.
Hello, Richard.
And Daniel Freeb.
Hi, Richard.
And maybe Dan Lloyd as well. Is Dan Lloyd joining us? Dan, hello.
I'm in the distance. I'm coming in close now.
Dan Lloyd's joining us.
And wearing his sparkle dust.
Yeah, wearing his official Giro d'Italia tracksuit top. Very nice, Dan. We're in Belfast City Hall and we're looking out over the opening ceremony to the big start to the Giro. Quite surreal to be in Belfast, isn't it? How's it gone for you so far, Lionel?
Well, I left my umbrella on the kitchen table before flying out here. That would have been handy. It has rained on and off today. And I left my waterproof in the hotel this afternoon.
To be fair, it hasn't rained at all for the opening ceremony, so it's been quite a success. It's been a bit of sunshine as well.
It has a little bit, I'm afraid. Yeah, a little bit about 15, 20 minutes ago, but it's fine. It hasn't dampened the spirits.
Dan's coming in here with an updated weather report.
Dan, I was going to say, you said it hasn't rained so far at the team's presentation, but I'm pretty sure those umbrellas weren't to keep the sun off the backs of their heads.
Well, you never know. You never know. People are very pale here. I'm, as a fellow Celt, I know how sensitive we are to the sun. Daniel, you've obviously attended lots of... This is Daniel Freeb. You've attended lots of Giro opening ceremonies, I would imagine, in your career of attending opening ceremonies. How does this one compare?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot more fuss being made about this one than I think ones that I've attended in the past. In fact, they've been pretty unmemorable. This is more like a Tour de France presentation, sort of the stage and the number of people. No, it's good. Good
atmosphere.
Well,
I'll tell you what, Belfast has certainly turned out in large numbers for it. And, you know, as soon as you arrive in the city, as we all did at some point today, the amount of banners, posters, bikes sprayed pink, the city has really embraced the Giro, hasn't it? And even taxi drivers and people like that I was speaking to, very enthusiastic about it, slightly disappointed at the lack of business so far, but I think a lot of people were arriving today and will arrive when the race itself starts. So that's been my impression anyway, that Belfast is really on fête for the Giro.
Yeah, it is. I mean, we've got to bear in mind this is a ticketed event. They gave tickets away and they got snapped up in, you know, a matter of hours. So everybody here, you know, unlike the presentation that will be in Yorkshire for the start of the Tour de France, where the ticket prices are I think £45 to £85 to attend that. You know, this is very much for the people, taking the Giro d'Italia to the people of Belfast.
On this, our Giro d'Italia cycling podcast preview show, we have interviews with Ryder Hegedal, Charlie Wigelius, Chris Yule Jensen, and Nicholas Roach. And we're, of course, delighted to be joined by Dan Lloyd, former professional with Garmin Sharp and Cervelo.
The Cycling Podcast, interviews and analysis. We've got the big talking points covered.
Right, let's talk about the race then, because we're not here to talk about the opening ceremony all night. What about the race? What do we expect? This is our preview show, so we're going to look forward especially to the first 3 days in Ireland. Two stages around Belfast, starting with the team time trial, and then a stage down to Dublin. Dan Lloyd, what are your thoughts on the opening few days? What are your? Have you studied the parkour?
I've studied it in much detail, really, but I have had a quick look at the first couple of road stages, which eventually take them down to Dublin. I think we've got clear favourites for the team time trial on Friday's stage in Orica Green Edge. It almost seems to be, you know, the journalists, etc., talking about, you know, which rider they're going to gift the pink jersey to, rather than, you know, seeing there's any massive competition. Of course, they haven't really got a GC guy here, so the team time trial and that pink jersey are massive goals for them coming into it. So it'll be a real loss for them if they do get beaten by somebody else. You've got Santarometer, he's of course Italian. Will they give it to him? Will they give it to Sven Tuff, the Canadian, because it's his birthday? Michael Matthews, of course, has maybe a chance of going
hair.
Into
they
it.
They might give it to him because he's got good hair. No, Matthews.
Yeah, you never know how these Australians are going to think about things, do you? But
it's interesting, Dan. I was talking to, I think Lionel it was, earlier today, about how that team has really won in flurries almost throughout their existence. You know, with the start of the tour last year, notably in Corsica, they just had this purple patch, incredible purple patch, and they've had it again in the last 10 days, haven't they?
Yeah, they certainly have. You know, Geraint's taking, you know, pretty much a surprise victory at Liège-Bastogne-Liège, and Albacete in his home race at Tour de Romandie was just incredible. And I was talking to Matt White earlier, actually, and I was saying to him, you know, in some ways they're quite similar riders. Neither of them have got huge engines. They're not the best climbers or time trialists or sprinters, but they both, you know, really take their opportunities when they come along. You know, if they've got an aim, or, you know, they think that they can do well in a race, they can pretty much be guaranteed to cross the line first. And it's something, you know, that's great to have within a team, especially a team like Orica, where they haven't really got somebody that's a favourite for a 3-week race in the general classification. They've got to take those opportunities, and over the last couple of weeks they certainly have.
I got a bit of a hard time for saying that Simon Gerrans' win at Liège-Bastogne-Liège was not lucky, but it favoured an opportunist, and he is an opportunist. It wasn't a criticism. And they are a team of opportunists. The problem with a team like that is it can either all go right or all go wrong, can't it? And I think that maybe explains why they sort of build up momentum, and you know, suddenly, as you know, Dan, being a former rider yourself, if you feel that you can seize a chance, then you invariably do. And it tends to either go all right for them or all wrong.
Looking at their squad, the team time trial, I mean, they've got 2.5 generations of Australian team pursuit squads in there. Luke Durbridge, Michael Hepburn, Brett Lancaster, Cameron Meyer, and as you say, Tuff, the Canadian, is kind of he's basically an engine, isn't he? I mean, this is his territory. It does look like all they need to do is just link the carriages together, and one of their riders will be in the pink jersey for the opening road stage, and then of course Michael Matthews will, you know, it's apart from sort of Marcel Kittel, it's not a massively sprinter heavy field, I don't think, is it, Daniel?
No, I don't think so. Kittel's obviously the outstanding sprinter. I mean, you always get some of the Italian sprinters.
Viviani's in form as well, isn't he?
Yeah, in this kind of minor teams as well, always bring someone, but I think Kittel really should have it all his own way. Would you agree, Dan?
We've got Nasser Bouhanni as well, who of course not won a stage of a Grand Tour yet, but has again shown great form so far in 2014 already. But I think you have to, I agree with you, you know, Kittel on paper is head and shoulders above the rest when it comes to a flat out sprint finish.
And what a head and shoulders.
Yeah,
what a head and shoulders.
The one unknown with the Giro is that often the stage finishes are quite narrow, gnarly, and there can be sort of unclassified, sort of hidden climbs that don't really appear on the race profile. And, you know, they might favour, you know, Bouhanni on certain days, who's really almost a kind of glorified puncher. He goes up short climbs very well. And he's actually looked to be kind of emerging from the pack of those almost second and third tier sprinters this year. And he's kind of, he's getting, I wouldn't say he's getting close to the sort of Greipel, Kittel, Cavendish triumvirate, but he's not that far away.
No, there's quite a few people that are, you know, pretty close to those three. And, you know, I guess there's, you know, a couple here last year. Bouhanni was here last year, Viviani was here last year, and both of them came close, but they came up against a very informed Mark Cavendish, and in some ways I expect they're a bit disappointed that Cav's not here, but Kittel is, because, you know, he's really looked unbeatable pretty much since last year's Tour de France, hasn't he?
Right, let's pause it there and listen to a couple of riders who were in City Hall earlier waiting to go out on stage. We spoke to 1.5 Irishmen, Chris Yule Jensen and Nicholas Roach, both Tinkoff Saxo teammates. Now, Chris Yule Jensen speaks with quite a heavy Irish accent mixed with a bit of Danish. And he grew up in Ireland and lived here for 6 years before moving with his Danish parents back to Denmark. And he represents Denmark. So quite an interesting guy to hear, very engaging character, riding his first Grand Tour. So we'll hear from him first, and then we'll hear from his team leader, Nicholas Roach. So Chris, you're almost the fourth Irishman here. How does it feel to be competing in almost your home country?
Oh, it's a fantastic feeling. Not only is it my first Grand Tour start, it's going to be starting my what you can call my old home country. I was born and raised in Wicklow, south of Dublin, and I lived there for 16 years. So to be back is really special.
You've got a kind of mixture of Irish and Danish going on there, but the Irish is pretty strong. I mean, you know, how if you were to put a percentage on your nationality, Danish and Irish? I know your parents are both Danish as well, aren't they?
Yeah, they are. But I think, of course, as soon as I landed here, the percentage increased quite a lot, because I've been in Denmark since 2005, and now as a pro, you're sort of all over the shop. But to be back is a really nice feeling, and I don't think I can deny that my Irish blood is running pretty thick at the moment.
Was there ever a chance of you competing for Ireland? Was that quite a decision that you had?
Because I left at, you know, at an underage level, the decision just you know, came naturally to declare for Denmark. And also at the time, and still, you know, Denmark is, although it's a rather small nation cycling-wise, it's one of the most impressive cycling nations there is, especially for underage development. So when I had the opportunity to be part of that, you know, it was really a no-brainer. And that's not to say anything bad about the setup here in Ireland, but, you know, as a 16, 17-year-old that just wants to go fast on the bike, and when you're living in Denmark at the time, then it was just logical, really.
But sorry, you started cycling here, didn't you? I'm presuming you've got lots of friends here. So.
I was, funny enough, I had the privilege of doing the Youth Olympics with the Irish team in 2005. And not only, it was maybe 3-4 weeks after that, my parents and we decided to move to Denmark. Which was indirectly because of the cycling, because I had the opportunity to go to school where there was almost cycling as a subject, really. That eventually led to the whole family going over there, and for my parents to go back.
We have a lot of support out here.
The amount of support I can feel already is incredible. People are so encouraging, and I still, you know, I keep in contact with a lot of the people I grew up with, and also in the cycling environment. My old club, Sorrento CC, you know, they're always they're constantly following me in my progress. So it's you know, I'm overwhelmed when I then eventually come here, and I've reached so far that there's also a lot of people here from back home that are still following me. So it's going to make it feel that much more special.
And what are your hopes for the race? You've obviously got Nicholas Roach leading the team. What are your hopes personally and for the team?
Personally, you know, and it's not to sound unambitious, but it's to get through, because it's the first time I've done a Grand Tour in the 3 weeks bike racing, and then combined with the Italian mountains, it's going to be a bit of a mouthful. But so to get through, but also to make sure I get through. Contributing to the team, doing my job properly, which would be a supporting role for Nicholas and Rafa, our Polish GC hope. So for sure, get through as strong and healthy as possible, and having made a difference with regards to helping the team.
What can Nicholas do you think in this race?
Oh, I think for sure that both him and Rafa, they have a chance of making an impression in terms of stages and also GC. Nicholas, he proved in the Vuelta last year that he most definitely has the potential to make an impact on GC Grand Tour wise, and he reacts well to altitude. He's just been to altitude camp, so and he's now we've come out of Romandy, so I think both him and Rafa are where they're supposed to be, and now it's just about getting the show on the road.
Nicholas, GC or stages?
GC.
You rode you've ridden a GC in the past in Grand Tours, but the Vuelta last year seemed to be a sort of strange a change in approach for you. You were riding very aggressively, but you also ended up with your best GC placing. Was that a lesson from there, do you think?
Before, I think in cycling people have a short memory. In 2010 I was sixth, which is not that far behind. That took me a few years to kind of be there again. I've had troubled years with injuries and bad crashes at the wrong time, and I was fighting for that 10th, 12th position rather than top 5. I think last year was a relief more than anything else, because when I was 6th I lost everything on the last time trial, because I was also challenging for the podium at that time. But I also think that last year's Vuelta at the level was much higher, so I actually have a lot more satisfaction being 5th, and like you said, also riding that bit more aggressively, because I remember in 2010 when I was 6th I was riding extremely defensively and I wasn't taking any risks, because for me it was going to be my first kind of step, and I did everything to make sure I was going to stay there, and actually hoping that I was that time trial was going to be beneficial for me, and it ended up being that I lost a lot of time to my opponents, and I was actually 3rd or 4th, I think it was 4th today of the time trial, and I dropped down to 7th and then made it back up one. But August is very different than riding now. You know, I mean, last year that snowy day in the Vuelta cost me, or almost cost me. It depends how you see the approach, my podium chances. And you know, you expect to have at least 2 or 3 of those during the Giro. So it's going to be, I think, a different approach, and I want to go day by day. And you know, just I know the Giro is not as well set for me as the Vuelta. But then, you know, I wanted a new challenge, and I think...
And you had to ride it being in Ireland, didn't you?
Exactly.
Are you enjoying being here? How does this feel?
I am. It's been super busy. I've been non-stop. I feel like I've done 3 stages already. But, you know, it's also very exciting, and I don't regret any of the kind of attention that I'm giving away rather than relaxing.
But you're in good shape going to the race. You're feeling,
I think, I'm
in
good shape. Yeah, I felt pretty tired after Romandy because I did a big block with a training camp with the team, 3-week training camp, and then just going directly into Romandy. So I was a bit tired on Sunday, but I think things will work out. And you know, we've that actually Monday transfer might be beneficial for me too.
This is the Cycling Podcast with Richard Moore, Lionel Burney, and Daniel Freeb.
So we heard there first from Chris Yule Jensen, the half Irishman, half Dane, and Nicholas Roach. Nicholas Roach, interesting, because for several years he's been sort of battling for top 10 GC in Grand Tours and riding quite conservatively, quite defensively in pursuit of a high overall placing. And I think a few of us watching him have almost felt that he was possibly missing out on opportunities to try and win stages. And he took a different approach to the Vuelta last year. He rode very aggressively, but also in the course of riding very aggressively, actually ended up with his best ever Grand Tour finish. And I wonder, you know, as he explained there, that there were lessons from that, but he's still very much of the mind that he is going to be prioritising GC. It's going to be his main focus here. But you know, fairly conservative in his ambitions. That was my impression. You know, him and Dan Martin, actually, they're both sort of talking about top 10 being a goal. I think for Nicholas Roach as well, he's a bit not very certain about how he'll go at this time of the year compared to how he's gone in the past in the Vuelta. But it'll be interesting how Nicholas Roach approaches it, as much as anything, as much as how he finishes it.
Well, yeah, Daniel Lloyd here was just making the point just off air about the first 2 days being, or first 3 days being, about survival for the GC riders, not to concede any time, because the race won't be decided until the final week. It's all about getting to that final week in the best possible shape, perhaps more so in the Giro than in the Tour de France, although the Tour de France has backloaded with mountain stages the last couple of years, having a very late, very crucial mountain stage. But in the Giro particularly, you know, very, very hard stages tend to be all in the last week. And of course there's the uphill time trial as well, which will, you know, that will be the place where not just the strongest climber, but the climbing strongman, I think, will sort of come to the fore. And whether Nicholas Roach is really going to find himself up in the top 4 or 5, I'm not so sure, but certainly the second half of the top 10 is well within his reach.
It is a paradox, isn't it, that there's all this focus on the three Irishmen in the race, Philip Dagenham being the other one. All three of them will be regarding these Irish stages as you say, stages to just survive and get through. And I wonder if you, as a recent former rider, Dan, will that be frustration for them, that they will be in demand, there will be this thrill of riding on home roads and this sort of frustration that they maybe can't show themselves at their best here?
I guess there might be a little bit of that for them. I mean, I'm sure they're going to be, you know, absolutely joyed at the fact that they're, you know, getting so many shouts from the side of the road, and you know, it's once in a lifetime opportunity really for those guys to race a Grand Tour in their home country. You've already said that, you know, really these first 3 stages though are something which they want to get through without having lost any time. And I guess, you know, there's plenty of people, as we've got in the UK but also here in Ireland, that despite the heritage of the sport here, there's going to be a lot of people on the roadside who actually don't know the ins and outs of it, and they know that they've got 3.5 Irish riders here at the race and they want to see something from them. But in fact, the likelihood of us seeing, you know, any, you know, sparkle from any of those three is very unlikely until we get to the mountains of Italy.
Well, earlier, talking somebody you know very well, Daniel, Charlie Wagelius is the sports director of the Garmin Sharp team. 2 years ago, he kind of masterminded Ryder Heyerdahl's overall victory. You know, he's a very sort of clever, tactical mastermind. He kind of plots the way through the Grand Tours. And during his own career, you know, he really rode for a lot of Italian teams. He rode many more Giro d'Italia than he did Tour de France. So I asked him about the character of the race, what makes it special, and looking ahead at the as the race unfolds, how he thinks Garmin Sharp's chances might pan out.
So you spoke to Charlie Wiggillis, and I know Daniel spoke to Ryder Hesjedal, the winner 2 years ago. So I think we'll hear from Charlie, and then we'll go straight into hearing from Ryder.
Charlie, can you sum up the characteristics of the Giro d'Italia and what makes it the race that it is?
The soul of the race really reflects the Italian soul. It's exciting, different. It's unlike any other race, I think, in the world. I think it's a big event, but it doesn't have like the giant nature of the Tour de France. And from a technical point of view, I think the mountains here are harder than the Tour, steeper. But generally, you see things much more balanced towards the last week of the Tour of the race compared to the Tour de France.
In terms of the Italian culture and the Italian sort of way of life, it's quite a, you know, there's a bit of a mañana, I know that's a Spanish word, but there's a bit of a tomorrow we'll see kind of attitude to life, and you know, the days start a little bit less frenetically. Is that still reflected in the racing?
Not at all, no, because this is a race that's actually quite famous for having lots of transfers and long transfers, so there are long days here. And you know, the stages, they might start late, but sometimes the riders have done 100-150 kilometers in the buses before getting to the start, so it can be really hectic. I think it's actually a bit like you know, a bit of a carnival really, like anything could happen really. And also from a technical point of view, you know, with the fact that the race is run in May, the riders really experience a really wide range of weather temperatures. You know, I mean, it's raining now, but it could be 35 degrees in 4 days in the south of Italy.
So the old style Giro d'Italia, where the first 2 or 3 hours would be at a quite sedate pace, and then it would be absolutely, you know, crazy for the last hour or last hour and a half, that doesn't really happen anymore.
Yeah, I think I was actually lucky enough to race the last Giros that were run in that way when Cipollini was still racing and things were ridden off in a certain way. I mean, I haven't seen a local rider offering cakes to the rest of the field or ice creams for quite a few years, but that's the way cycling's gone in general. It's a bit of a shame, really.
And what about when the Grande Part, or the, you'll have to correct my Italian pronunciation, but the Grande Partenza is in a foreign country. Does that alter the character of the race? And what are you expecting from the Irish stages here?
I think there could be quite a lot of you know, unexpected traps lying around in Ireland, due to the roads, the weather, you know, and all these kinds of things. But logistically, it's a big challenge, obviously. But I think it's a really interesting thing that the race does, to go and explore new places and show itself to new places, because a lot of Anglo-Saxon countries and Nordic countries, they know cycling, but not so much the Giro. So it's a big challenge for everybody, the teams especially. But I think it's really a worthwhile experience.
And finally, your role as sports director for Garmin Sharp, you've got one of the potential favourites for the race, Daniel Martin. Is it a case of safety first in these stages and get back to Italy without having, you know, suffered any mishap or lost any time for a kind of a sort of needless reason?
Well, the first thing I'd say is I think we've got two favourites, because we've got Ryder Hesjedal here too, who's already won the race. I think trying to win these races is a question of hitting a balance between making sure that you never lose time and never cracking, because essentially the race is decided in the last week. So you just have to try and float around and make sure that you're never the one who gets caught out. But having said that, there's time bonuses, and you know, behind every corner can be an opportunity to put somebody else in difficulty. So you need to have kind of a soft focus and be able to take advantage of what comes your way.
Right, we've not seen that much of you so far this year. Is that a bit harsh?
It's been the same as the last two seasons, more or less. Started in Dubai, it was a pretty early start. Then Catalonia, properly, you know, proper start in Europe, and that's the same as the last two seasons. So as far as preparation goes, it's been the exact same. Catalonia, Pays Basque, and the Ardennes, so it's been the same. So I'm hoping for the same result as 2012.
And how do your sort of feelings compare, and how do the numbers in training compare to 2 years ago?
Yeah, good. I like to think I'm still improving. I mean, I felt really good on the bike actually the last couple of weeks. I had a little bit better rides by the end of the Ardennes the last couple of years, with, you know, top tens in the age, but I don't think that's the biggest indicator of all-around condition. And You know, it's all about the last week here, and I know if I get in the shape that I can be in, then that's my strong point, and that's what I'm going to be looking to do here.
What kind of race does it have to be for you to repeat what you did 2 years ago? I mean, obviously there are a lot of very, very strong climbers in the race.
It's the Giro. It's a grind from day one. You know, I might not be the strongest guy on the first mountaintop finish or the second one, but you know, it's about that last week, and I think I showed that in 2012, and before that, I mean, in the Tour in 2010. I mean, I was only behind the best climbers in the world on Tourmalet at the very end of the third week, so... You know, that's what I need. You know, I haven't won a stage race besides the Giro d'Italia, but you know, I'll take that one.
Earlier today, I took a cab, a taxi, and the driver, I think, took your wife somewhere yesterday, yeah. and he said that your wife was convinced that you're going to win again.
That's what it's all about. It's about having the people around you that support you and believe in you, and, you know, I guess maybe she's been seeing it and what I've been doing, and, you know, if she thinks it, then that's a good thing.
You're listening to the Cycling Podcast. Tweet us at cycling_podcast.
So that was Ryder Hesjedal, and before him, Charlie Wigelius. So we've talked a lot about the Irish stages, all looking forward to those stages immensely, and we'll be doing another podcast at the conclusion to those stages. But of course, it's a three-week race, set to be quite an intriguing overall battle. There's no real clear outstanding favourite. There's a clutch of four or five or six riders who might all be considered favourites. But Lionel, what are you most looking forward to, and who's your podium?
Well, I really want to see a Colombian duel between Nairo Quintana and Rigoberto Urán. I think it would be fantastic for the race. It would be fantastic for Colombian cycling. I think there's, you know, we know a lot about the Colombians and the Tour. You know, the first wave of Colombians that came over to race in Europe in the early 80s. And it does feel like we're getting a kind of a sequel to that. Seeing the Colombia team, you know, in their black kit with the national flag colours as well in the lineup, you know, it adds a sort of an extra kind of depth to the race. And it would be great if, you know, we had two riders from the same country on rival teams really going hell for leather in the mountains. I mean, the terrain in the final week suits both of them down to the ground. Talking about that time trial, that perhaps tips the balance slightly in the favour of Urán. Quintana will obviously, you know, relish the steeper summit finishes. You know, he's an out-and-out climber, isn't he? And so I just think if we were going into the final week with those two separated by sort of 20, 30 seconds, we could be in for a real kind of grandstand. And I think the Giro would benefit from having one of those sort of Pantani versus Tonkoff-style battles, a real kind of duopoly.
Well, and we are going back to the scene of that Tonkoff, the famous Tonkoff Pantani battle at Plan de Monte Campioni in tribute to Pantani in the final week. I mean, just looking at the Italians, Lionel, you said the Giro would benefit from, you know, a great sort of head-to-head battle. It would also benefit from a very strong challenge from the Italian riders. I don't necessarily think we'll see it, although Astana, I think, are going to be extremely strong. They've really brought, apart from Nibali, they've really brought an A-team to this race. We've got Scarponi leading and Fabio Aru, who's the big sort of young hope, the Sardinian rider, was very strong in the Giro last year. Expect him to climb well again and possibly make the top 10. Ivan Basso, the evergreen Ivan Basso at Cannondale, he was talking up his chances early in the year, still thinks he can win a Giro. I spoke to him tonight at the team presentation. He said, and the problem is he's just not had a single positive sensation, a signal in any race so far this year. He says he's done everything right, but he's just not felt good at all. And then I think Pozzo Vivo will be strong for AG2R La Mondiale. Pozzo Vivo, who of course has developed this miraculous time trialing ability in the last year or so. And Kunigo will flatter to deceive, as he always does, for Lamprey, I think. And is this too punchy?
This is all good. This is all good.
Well, all looking very positive for times. Like, when did it was 2003? Kunigo won the Giro, wasn't it?
2004.
Four. Sorry, apologies. So we are on the 10-year anniversary of his Giro win.
Yeah.
Which we thought at the time would be the first of many.
Yeah, and also at Lamprey, of course, there's Ulisse, who doesn't really think of himself as a GC rider, but I actually think he might turn into a better climber and GC rider than Kunigo. And I think so. And last couple, just worthy of a mention in dispatches, Cataldo, I think, will turn into Sky's de facto leader here, and I think he could easily finish in the top 10. And the last Italian I will mention is Ciro, our friend Ciro, who's not here. He didn't get the call up to the Giro.
Well, no, he's loitering in Vincenzo Nibali's bathroom, I expect, or something similar. I don't know. He's on Nibali duty for Gazzetta dello Sport, isn't he?
Yeah, I mean, the other name we haven't mentioned is Joaquin Rodriguez. I was speaking to somebody from Katusha earlier, and you know, he's been injured, and I think the feeling in the team is that he's perhaps not over that injury, and it might be a race a bit too early for him. He's riding the Giro and the Vuelta this year, still lacking that Grand Tour win. He's been so close over the last few years. Turns 35 on Monday as well, so time is definitely running out for him. But this Giro might be a bit too soon. Dan, have you got something to add to that?
Well, I mean, I spoke to him yesterday, if you want to call it. I don't speak Spanish, he doesn't speak English. We had an interpreter, and I said, you know, how are you after the Amstel crash? He said, completely fine, no worries at all. But he is Mr. Consistency when it comes to the Grand Tours. I think I was researching him for something recently, and I think something like 6 out of the last 7 that he started, he's finished in the top 4, but as you rightly said, never on top of the podium. And time's kind of in some ways running out, unless you compare him to Chris Horner, I guess. But you know, the years are going by, and he'll want to sort of finish on top of it sooner rather than later, I think, especially in a race which is so suited to him. But you know, the great thing about the Giro and the thing that I'm looking forward to are just the surprise, really. I mean, we've been through a few already, but we've got, you know, a couple of guys in Trek, Arredondo, another Colombian that might well spring a surprise, particularly on the steeper finishes. We've got an interesting Austrian, Zoida, I don't know exactly how you pronounce his name, but he was very good in the time trial at the Tour, the Med at the start of the year. I think he finished second behind Cummings there.
It's a bit of a hipster selection.
Well, you know, I did, you know, think you might invite me to the podcast, so I really did some proper research before I came here. But yeah, he came also to the Tour de Romandie recently and was, you know, reasonably good on the climbs, having come back from an injury sustained at a race towards the start of the year, and then a really good time trial just behind Duran in the top 5, I think. So he might be another guy that could surprise. But what I really look forward to on the Giro is not the mountain stage, not the flat stage, but those kind of in-between ones that, you know, that you shouldn't really make an impact on the general classification, but sometimes can. I'm thinking of stages like last year where, in the end, Paolini won on his own and went into the pink jersey, but we'd had attacks from Hesjedal, who at the time was a big favourite for the race, coming into it as the defending champion and really putting, you know, other people into disarray, and there's plenty of those stages on offer this year.
Remember 2010 as well was a famous year when it was a race that was really all over the place. Maybe we'll see a stage like that here in Ireland. Who knows? The weather could be a factor. You know, the wind could certainly be a factor, couldn't it, on day one, on the first road stage in particular.
Yeah, I had a quick look today, actually, at my favourite site, Windfinder, from when I was racing. We always used to look at that. And actually, the first road stage around the Northern Ireland parts looks predominantly to me, especially when it goes to the coast, like a head crosswind, which in general doesn't see so many splits or likelihood of splits. But on day 3, going down to Dublin, you've got a really, really strong westerly wind, and it goes and hits the coast there, and they're heading actually sort of southeast. So they're going to have a cross tailwind there if the forecast is right, which is, you know, when it can become really dangerous. And actually, I do like to see, you know, GC riders squirm, because that's not their territory. They like to make the differences on the climbs, of course, and perhaps on the time charges.
You're actually rubbing your hands together with almost glee at the prospect of crosswinds.
Crosswinds, yeah. I mean, I just think it's just a fantastic form of racing. And you know, we always end up seeing the same guys in the front in crosswinds and Qatar, etc., with Bonan there, and you know, they're just absolute experts. And it's, you know, it's not by chance, it's not just because they're the strongest, they're very, very clever as well. And there's, you know, certain ways of riding in crosswinds which give you a big advantage. Some teams know about it and some teams don't, and I think it's a situation that, you know, the likes of Basso, etc., all of the GC guys don't really like to get into. But you know, from that point of view, I like to see, you know, what happens on those stages.
And Dan Martin, of course, who we mentioned earlier, is nicknamed Crosswinds by his Garmin Sharp teammates. I think the story behind that dates back to a conversation a few years ago. I think Dan Martin was a Neo Pro, and they were talking about crosswinds around the dinner table, and he announced, I know how to ride crosswinds, I'm brilliant in crosswinds, always good in crosswinds as an amateur. And I think they went out the next day, I don't know where it was, but I think Dan Martin was firmly in the gutter and then in the broom wagon.
put in his place. Well, we haven't mentioned another couple of names. Cadel Evans, I think he'll be good in this Giro. I'd put him on the podium, I think. I think my podium would be Quintana, Evans and Uran, I think. But, you know, that could all change if Dan's prediction for crosswinds on Sunday comes true. Who knows? We haven't mentioned Ben Swift. Well, I think Ben Swift will have a good Giro. I think finally he could win a stage of a Grand Tour. He's ridden a couple now, he's ridden a few. Went very close in his first Giro, didn't he, to a stage win.
I think Sky really need to work for him. I mean, they've come here now without Port, without Kenyuk. You know, that's two big losses for their team. But Swift, I mean, that stage he won in the Basque Country was just incredible. I mean, I kept seeing a Sky rider in this group that was whittling down to 12, 15 riders full of, you know, pure climbers. And it turned out it was him that was there. I mean, he had a horrendous year in 2013 with injury. But, you know, coming back and doing that stage there and winning it, but the climbing legs he had, I think that they need to ride on the hilly stages, which could end up in a sprint in a way that drops the other pure sprinters, so he's got a great chance of a stage win,
and which could also potentially put him in contention for the points jersey as well. You know, Mark Cavendish won it last year. Why could a rider but like Ben Swift? There is talk of him not riding the whole Giro, and, you know, perhaps riding half of it and resting up for the Tour perhaps. But if he was in contention for the points jersey, then surely that would be a goal well worth aiming for. The question is whether Sky would do that, I guess.
I certainly think so. I mean, you never know who's planning to pull out, because it's not something, of course, a team or a rider wants to really announce before the start of a major Grand Tour. I very much doubt Kittel's going to go all the way through with, you know, ambitions at the Tour de France again this year, and possibility of going into the yellow jersey on the first day again there. But yeah, I think Swifty, Michael Matthews, you know, the guys that are, you know, going to be consistent on the flat out sprint stages, but can also get over a number of climbs, because the points system as well as the bonus second system, I think, has changed slightly, hasn't it? So it, you know, previous years we saw climbers, I think for the last 3 years before Cavendish, was always the climbers that ended up in the points jersey. But, you know, the way they've changed things really gives it you know, ambition to these fast guys as well.
Just on the minor jerseys and the mountains classification in particular, I'm sure at some point we will see Stefano Pirazzi contending, probably in that jersey, and generally just winding everyone up by attacking on every single climb.
Well, I think we'll leave it for now, and we'll return at the end of these Irish stages. But Lionel, thank you very much.
Thank you, Richard.
Daniel,
thanks. No Lionel Richie reference tonight.
No Lionel. No, did he ever? He must. Any Irish Lionel Richie connection? I can't believe you've not looked this up.
Yeah, I usually do, but I haven't tonight.
And Dan Lloyd, thank you very much for joining us. Your debut appearance. We'll leave you to Windfinder. I think you're off to spend the evening surfing Windfinder, are you?
I have actually downloaded the app onto my phone, so you might well be right.
The Cycling Podcast. Subscribe on iTunes, listen on Audioboo, and visit us at thecyclingpodcast.com.